Good afternoon, everyone. I had hoped against hope that I would not have to have this particular press conference in which I am going to cancel some regular season games. We worked hard to avoid an outcome that's bad for our fans, bad for our players, and bad for our clubs. I want to assure our fans that our failure to reach an agreement was not due to a lack of effort by either party.
Hi, this is Emily Nyman, and you're listening to Breaking Balls. Welcome to episode 96 of Breaking Balls. I'm your host, Emily Nyman. I'm once again joined by my co-host, John Snyder. You can find us on Twitter, at BreakBallsPod, or if you're feeling brassy, give the Breaking Balls hotline a call, 631-820-7377. He did it. He canceled games. And he acted like he actually had to, like he was forced, like he had a knife up to his throat.
Folks, in case you don't know who Emily's talking about, it's me. It's John.
No. Manfred was just a puppet. That's where John was last week.
Well, you know, I have to say, by the way, before we get into this, I am a little resentful that you had to go ahead and come down with COVID and take away my triumphant return. Now it's your return too, so I guess I'm sharing this with you too. Now granted, I was the one who gave you COVID, but I feel as if that is neither here nor there when it comes to me complaining about shit.
And classic Breaking Balls curse. I mean, I should have known because I recorded that episode like, you know, it's just me this week because we want to keep me and DJ Bingington safe. Literally, by the time we released the episode, I had full-blown COVID.
The damage had been done. Yes.
It was a ridiculous thing for me to assume that it wouldn't happen. I knew it was coming. Just like I knew that these canceled games were coming. I mean, there was just no way that they were going to come to a deal. The sides were way too far apart, and I will admit, I did get a little wrapped up in the, now that I'm saying it, it sounds absolutely fucking stupid, but I did get wrapped up in the pre-arbitrary deadline, Bob Nightingale-induced hysteria on Twitter.
I actually had him on notifications for like 2 hours there. It was a new high for Bob. I have to be honest, Emily, like coming into this conversation, I'm a little nervous because there is so much to cover. Like, it's funny, like, you know, normally little behind the scenes stuff, like, you know, we'll have our notebooks and we're like, you know, we'll number everything we're talking about. This is like all one big topic, and there's so much that went down, and there's so much to dig into and pick apart, and there's so many narratives, false and accurate, that are flying around. It's just insane, you know, even to the point where like opening day has now been canceled officially, and a lot of fans don't know.
Yeah,
I'm talking to people I know, you know, Mets fans, Yankee fans, like some casual, some who I wouldn't really even consider casual, like people who like really follow baseball once they get going, they have no idea what's going on. And it's the propaganda coming out from MLB. It's a combination of that. It's relying on the casuals for, well, they're not going to know the difference until opening day comes or maybe like the week before. It's like, wait, what do you mean it's not happening? Yeah. Versus, you know, people who are a little bit more serious who are, and I've had some of these conversations, unfortunately, they're buying the company line. Hook, line, and sinker, and they're parroting lines back to you, and it's so frustrating when you know what's going on, when you're paying attention, you're listening to the right sources, and most people aren't, and that's what MLB is relying on, and it's working. It is.
I mean, if anything has proven the theory that, like, frenzy in the media, especially in baseball in particular, that whips up interest even beyond, like, people like us and people like the Twitter community and our listeners. So that's what MLB did the other night, because they saw like the free agent frenzy right before the lockout. And then they did the same thing the other night where they made it seem like they were going to come to a deal. And then, of course, that gets people back talking about baseball again. And then everyone was all pissed off when it didn't happen, even though it was still, I was definitely being naive in like my hope of hope. Like, I'm hoping that this is going to be a deal.
No, but you know what?
This ain't happening.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to stop you right there. You were not naive. I don't believe that, because you know what? I was just about to say, let me compliment you, damn it. no, seriously though. I was just about to say, like, I the whole thing feels personal as a big baseball fan, but like this is where it really got personal for me because I bought it too. They did a real good job of leaking to the right people. I'm not calling out names necessarily, but they did a great job of getting us excited, getting like, okay, now they're putting in the work, you know, to the point where they could almost kind of like diminish our like, oh, you know, you waited 45 days to do it. It's like, okay, well, they're doing it now. Okay, great. They're going till 2 a.m. Like, oh, they're finally taking this seriously. I bought it too, Em. Like, don't feel bad. Like, that we just did exactly what they wanted us to do. And then they pulled that fast one. Like, well, we don't like the player's tone anymore. So, no, there will not be a deal. It was all manufactured.
It is really funny, like, how easily we've all bought bullshit bureaucracy. Because it's not even just in this situation with MLB where, like, they're the ones who locked out the players. They're the ones who have imposed arbitrary deadlines that are not necessary. Like, so many companies will do that, too. Like, well, sorry, it's our policy. It's like, okay, but you're the one who made the policy. No one else is making you have this policy. You can change that shit. So this idea that's like, oh, well, we worked to the deadline. Like, in Manfred's press conference the next day when he canceled the first two series of the season, a reporter asked him straight up, like, well, what happened to the first 43 days after you guys locked out the players and before you submitted your first proposal? And his response was like, well, we've been here for the last 10 days, and that's all I have to say about that. And it's like, okay, I guess that's that on that. No one cares.
So two things on that press conference. One of the many people that our listeners should be following is Ken Rosenthal, because now that Ken Rosenthal has been unleashed from the MLB machine, he has...
We like him now.
Exactly. He's one of the good guys now. Yeah, he is fully on board, and it's great to read. But him throwing Manfred under the bus, some of the stuff in his article was borderline petty, and they deserve it, and I'm here for it. Him saying... I'm going to butcher the line, but it was something like, you know, Rob Manfred's inadequacies as a public speaker have been long established. And it's true because we have all those pictures of him, you know, smiling during this press conference.
Laughing even,
right. Any PR professional would tell you if you're in Rob Manfred's position there, you got to keep it somber and like keep the tone down. And, you know, we're not happy about this.
Yeah, like as if this is fucking horrible news and deeply sad for all fans and everyone involved.
Exactly. But this clown is just so, he's such a bad public speaker and he's so uncomfortable and that nervous energy. How this guy was a labor negotiator is beyond me, but that's neither here nor there. That it's not hard over the course, you know, when you actually watch the press conference, he is just uncomfortably laughing the whole time. Like it wasn't like they caught like one moment, it was consistently. And to add on to that, Jason Hayward on Instagram pointed out, I'm going to say rightfully, I don't know this for sure, but I think he's right about this. He said, this motherfucker is laughing because he's relieved, because the owners never wanted to have these April games. He was worried that the players might actually take that deal, but then they didn't. And it was the biggest wave of relief that he's experienced. And then he goes out and does that press conference in the windy Florida. I thought your echo was fucking up when we were listening to it. It was all like, what the hell is that? Oh, they're outside in Florida. Good production value, MLB. That's where that money's going.
They were in that parking lot, probably too. That was like the in-between. That's like the no man's land. So they're like, let's do the press conference in no man's land of this parking lot in Roger Dean Stadium.
And it'll seem like trenches, literally.
It'll seem like we are, you know, both siding this as if it's both sides. And Hayward's comment is probably pretty spot on because he knows it, just like everyone that's been paying pretty close attention knows it, that this isn't about this CBA. And I know that sounds really crazy because it's the CBA that this is all these negotiations are happening under. But the reason why Manfred was relieved that the players didn't just accept or whatever is because they want to fucking break the union. If they can't absolutely slam dunk on the players in this CBA like they have for like the last two or three, then they want to break the union. It was one or the other. So as soon as the players put up any sort of roadblock to their first proposal, that was when, okay, now we're just going to fucking throw all the chips in and we are just going to try to break these motherfuckers. And that's what's happening now.
And, you know, to throw out another person that we should all be following, Eugene Friedman, who is fantastic insight into the ins and outs of labor negotiations for us, you know, normal people, I guess, who don't know anything about that.
He's a labor lawyer.
He's a labor lawyer, right. So he knows his shit. He was speaking about maybe even the possibility, and you know, they might not be able to do it, but of filing a grievance, because technically it's illegal to not negotiate in good faith. It's not just something that's like, oh, well, they should be doing this. Like, no, technically you have to do that.
Right.
And I don't know if they have quite enough to prove it. I mean, you know, it might not be enough, but I mean, and I say this as a layperson, like, what else do they need? It's so obvious that it's like banging my head against the wall. You know, it's like, what do you mean there's not proof of this? You know what I mean?
And it's really tough as a fan to like wrap your brain around all of this, because we're being thrown a lot of numbers and they are seemingly in a vacuum almost, or they're only being compared to like the previous year. So when, you know, the owners will be like, oh, well, we proposed a hike in the CBT by X amount, it seems like it's a lot. But then when you consider the rises in revenue every year, and it was Craig Goldstein, who's the editor-in-chief for Baseball Prospectus, he pointed it out. He said that, just a reminder that if the competitive balance tax had grown with revenues over the CBAs, that tax would be at $297 million. Right now, it is at $220 million. So try to keep that perspective. And I'm almost saying this for myself, too, because it's easy, even on the players, it's easy to like put everything in a vacuum and act like there's no precedence. It doesn't matter the past. But of course it matters, because you have people who have owned teams for fucking 20 years, 30 years.
And you know, an interesting point that going back to Ken Rosenthal that he made in the article that he put out was even saying maybe in retrospect, the players should have asked for a 1-year extension, like formally, of the current CBA, just because the owners are using this bullshit tactic of like, oh, look, revenues have been struggling. Well, yeah, no kidding. There were 60 games in 2020 and, you know, attendance was low last year because of the pandemic. This year had, well, I almost used present tense. Maybe it's had now, unfortunately, had the chance to be a normal season, you know, somewhat normal season. You know, COVID restrictions are being lifted. We had no reason to think that by May or June, ballparks wouldn't be as full as they ever were. And so there's almost the argument of like, well, let them get a year of, you know, quote unquote, normal revenue under their belts and then make the argument, because the owners are just trying to take them to the cleaners right now, you know, with that whole disingenuous, well, let's not get into the specifics, but, you know, revenue's down. So, you know, we got to do something about that. Like, yeah, okay, that's convenient.
Which is fantastic because, of course, we only have the one team. The Braves are a publicly traded company, so their financials are released. And this year, I'm not going to get into nitty-gritty half because I don't really understand a lot of it, but someone, you know, put it in layman's terms that they suffered a $53 million loss in 2020, which, not to, you know, poo-poo $53 million, but
that's
in the grand
scheme. That's like the
scheme,
whole Pirates.
Right, and in the grand scheme, that's not that much fucking money for teams like this, but
it's really not.
I digress. In 2021, they gained $104 million. So they already recouped the money lost in 2020. Granted, the Braves went on a playoff run and won the World Series, but they were pretty bad for the majority of the year. They totally underperformed. So it's not like they were on this fantastical run from day one. They still managed to make their money back and then still make money. So don't give me this line, oh my God, the revenues are down. No, they are fucking not. I don't need to see all of the revenue on their fucking balance sheets to know as much.
Well, and you know what's funny too, because and Max Scherzer has been fantastic as one of the spokespeople for the union, and not just because he finally updated all of his Twitter shit to the Mets, but that's besides the point. Not really, but it's besides the point. No, but he went out of his way to point something out with the CBT, you know, talking about revenues being publicly available as information. The CBT, as it stands now, and again, don't get confused, and I say this as the co-host, don't get confused between collective bargaining agreement and competitive balance tax, which is the luxury tax. The acronyms are close. I'll take that one on the chin for you, Emily.
Thank you.
Yeah. But so the CBT, the luxury tax, as it stands now, it essentially functions as a salary cap, except that it's not a salary cap, because a salary cap requires teams, as I understand it, to make their revenues at least knowledgeable within the league, because that's what the salary cap is based on. Right. And with a salary cap, if you look at, you know, NBA, NFL, NHL, they all have it. There's also a salary floor inherent. It's part of the revenue sharing, the money that these teams get, they have to put it towards payroll. And so that's part of it. Like, these owners want to, you know, they want to punish overspending like that, but at the same time, they don't want to have to, you know, if there was a floor, they'd have to spend, you know, $100 million, you know, $150 million, whatever the floor would be. Bob Nutting doesn't want that. He wants to field this fucking $51 million a year team and lose and come in last every year, and on we go. So Max Scherzer did a great job of pointing out, it's like, they want to have their cake and eat it too, essentially. And right now they kind of are. What's tough is like, and then, you know, to bring in another player, like Mike Trout finally spoke out as well on Instagram, kind of saying like, hey, listen, like, players are all on the same page here. Like, we're holding the line, and this is, so many people don't understand this and they need to. It's so much bigger than this season. You know what I mean? It's almost to the point where like, and I almost hesitate to say this, but like, if they had to lose the whole season, that would suck tremendously, like unbelievably. But if it winds up long-term working out for the players to do that, to get what, you know, get their demands met, I would almost have to support it. You know what I mean? And it feels so gross being like, yeah, maybe the right thing to do is not play a whole season. But it's like, what are they going to do? Otherwise, the owners have them by the balls. There's nothing they can do. That's the only leverage they have, is all those backloaded contracts when the playoffs kick in, and that's where the owners make their money. They don't give a shit about April.
And Scherzer and all these guys being the mouthpiece, and they're always the ones, you see all the comments underneath, you know, Scherzer's post and Trout's post. Trout posts one time, the first time, about anything that's not weather or baseball, and he has all these negative comments under it. But people are like, you know, oh, you've made your money. You know, what about the guys who can't afford to miss games, yada, yada. Beyond the fact that they're all in the same union and the union lets everyone know what the moves are going to be, they vote on things. Like, that's the whole point, that the union is negotiating on behalf of all of its members. But that aside, do people really think that someone like Max Scherzer or Mike Trout, who have made, you know, $500 million in their career, or at the end of their career in Scherzer's case, that they're going to cancel the season? They care about what the league minimum is as far as their money that they can make. Like, they're doing this for the players that don't make any money because they've already made all their fucking money. It would be very easy for them to just, let's accept this. Let's just move on. Let's play ball. It would be easy for them to do that. And if they did, they would also get killed for that by fans. So what do people want? Do they want the guys with a platform and who actually have leverage and power to be the spokesperson for the league and for their fellow union members? Or do they want them to throw them under the bus like they have for the last two or three CBAs?
No, it's true. I mean, that's especially with Max Scherzer. Let's not forget, he just got what essentially amounted to a blank check deal from Steven Cohen. And he's ready to leave that on the table this year to go to bat for these other players. That's no joke, man. Scherzer's the real deal. So happy he's on my team.
And the union has stipend that they dish out to all of its members. I'm not sure what they'll do with the guys that would be on the 40 but start in the minor leagues. Like, that's a little bit of a gray area there that I'm not really sure.
I think I saw 15,000 for April or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's for, I was confused if it was for the whole year or what, but they're all entitled to it. I don't know how the guys at the top of that scale handle that. Like, does, you know, Max Scherzer really need a fucking $15,000 stipend? I'd say not, but he's one of the 1,200 members of the union. So I would imagine guys like that put it back into the fund or whatever they're legally allowed to do. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Or like, do they have to take it because it's like a union thing? Or I don't know. I don't want to speculate because I'd be talking out of my ass.
One bright spot this week.
Okay, good. I think you're speaking of talking out of his ass.
Derek Jeter, CEO or former CEO for the Miami Marlins, former shareholder for the Miami Marlins, he stepped down a few hours before the quote unquote deadline imposed by the league. And he was quoted as saying, "The vision for the future of the franchise is different than the one I signed up to lead. Now is the right time for me to step aside as a new season begins." All right. First of all, Derek Jeter said, fuck you to the Marlins owners and the rest of the owners because he did not sign up for this. This guy was just in the union for 20 years and he retired less than 10 years ago. So there was no way he was going to sit idly by for this. And the fact that he said, this is the time, this is the right time, that's like saying it without saying it, you know, because he knew that they weren't going to come to a deal and there wasn't going to be any games. So he knew, now's the time for me to do this because I'm on the front office ownership side, but I'm now defecting from them and basically saying, I don't agree with the direction this is going in. This is not what I signed up for. I'm out of here. And dude, I've had my issues with Jeter in the past as an A-Rod fan, but holy shit. I was like beaming with pride like I was his fucking mother or some shit. When I saw that, I was like, yes, this is my fucking dude right here.
Oh, what? So now you're passing it to me. Now I have to compliment Derek Jeter on record.
Yes, you better. You God absolutely better.
No, hey, man, credit where credit's due. That was the move, and he did it. You know, he could have. Because, you know, let's also remember who Derek Jeter is. Derek Jeter was never an outspoken player who, like, made splashes in the media and stuff. You know, the most scandalous thing was the gift baskets with women that he slept with, you know?
Which is honestly kind of nice. I mean,
it is. It's like, that's your scandal? That's kind of adorable in a weird, like, kind of endearing almost. So, yeah, as a player that, you know, when he was most in the public eye, was not prone to making splashes, we could also easily see Derek Jeter just kind of like, well, you know, this isn't my fight. Put his head down. Just like, you know, just do his job. But he didn't do that. He made a statement. You know, he doesn't. I mean, also, he's Derek Jeter. He doesn't need this gig. You know what I mean? He doesn't need any of this. So, yeah, fuck that. He's a player first and foremost. He'll always be a player first and foremost. All the respect in the world to Jeter for doing that. That was the move, man. And he did it.
Because what the CBA and all this bullshit boils down to is really competitive integrity. That's really at the heart of all of this. And love him or hate him, Jeter has competitive integrity. And that's the message that he sent, that, like, this fucking league is fucking whack right now. I wish, imagine he said that.
Yeah, really. Should have been a statement. Yeah, like, at the end of the statement. Oh, also, fuck Rob Manfred. One interesting thing, and I'm not saying this because I necessarily espouse it as gospel, but I thought it was a really interesting take. Disha Thosar of the Daily News has been on a roll with some good articles lately. She's one who's not afraid to call things as they are, as far as the owners go. She wrote an article that was really interesting in terms of the CBT as they're trying to make it is real. And you looked at what the owners were proposing. It got as high as like 100% penalties after a certain,
insane,
you know,
penalties.
Insanely high, right. And it's like, well, who's going to go that high? Who's going to spend that kind of money and get punished? Oh, I don't know. Maybe like Steve Cohen of the New York Mets, who has more money than all of the other owners. And it's not just Cohen. It's, you know, the Dodgers spending a lot of money. And there's other teams, too. But Cohen is the easiest one to finger for this because, you know, $14 billion, obviously. And it's an interesting take. And it might be accurate, you know, because he's clearly willing to spend. He proved that in his first full... I almost said full offseason. But, you know, with first offseason that started when he owned the team, even in that small window before the CBA expired, the dude opened up the checkbook, you know, especially with that Max Scherzer deal. That was the clear signal that, like, you know, Lindor to a lesser extent, but Scherzer especially, like, hey, I'm spending money. The Mets had already blown through the current luxury tax already before the CBA expired. Again, I keep coming back to Bob Nutting, both because I like the Pirates and I hate their owner.
What a terrible name. Bob,
yeah, right. Yeah, poor guy. No, but I mean, yeah, you think Bob Nutting wants to have to compete with Steve Cohen, you know, $300 million payroll, whatever he winds up with? Like, hell no. That's six times what he's paying his guys right now. And let's remember, if I have this number correctly, someone correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that out of the 30 owners, 23 are required to agree on something to make it happen. So that means I'm pretty sure that's right. That means that if only eight of them don't want something, they don't have to do it. And that's all those bottom, you know, the Diamondbacks and the Orioles and, you know, all these bad teams. It's like
half the league.
Oh, and the Pirates. I almost didn't say the Pirates again.
Yeah, literally like fucking 40% of the league.
That's what I'm saying. And so they don't want any of this. And so it's just an interesting, and I don't want to misframe this in terms of this isn't about empathy or sympathy for the owners, nothing like that.
Right, it's just another interesting side.
It's just
of
an
this.
Interesting component to it. Let's remember, when we're talking about the owners as a collective, obviously they're going to function as a collective because they have to. Otherwise, you know, I said to Emily jokingly aside, can you imagine if Steve Cohen just blew all this up, just tweeted like, just pay them? Like it would be chaos for the owners.
Or
if he did
just
that.
Starts his own league.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
Just SCLB.
He just volunteers this season to pay everybody's payrolls. Can we just make this happen, please? I really want to see my toys out in the field.
And now, I almost said we're at an impasse, but Manfred specifically said in his press conference for, you know, really for legal reasons, they're not technically at an impasse. And like John mentioned earlier, you could check out why that seemingly semantical situation matters in Eugene Friedman's Twitter thread, because he explained it the other day. But now they met today informally to play, you know, the two lead negotiators.
Yeah, that's what you want to hear. Well, you know, it's a casual meeting. We'll see what happens. Like, just spare me. Just don't bother them.
Like, one of them called. They're like, you're going to wear sweats, right? I'm wearing sweats.
No pictures.
So, I mean, if it's informal and that's where we're fucking starting right now, I guess it's better than not talking at all. But informal means that nothing really was going to get accomplished there. It was just like, let's just fucking show up and talk, and now we have something to show to the fans that we're trying.
And also, not for nothing, just to zoom out and look at the big picture for a second. You want to talk about being at an impasse? They're not, because it's completely imposed by the owners.
Right,
if you take
exactly.
away nothing else from this conversation, when you're talking with your idiot friends who are saying that it's, you know, it's both sides'
both
fault,
sides.
It's the players, The owners impose the lockout. They can, at any time they want, remove the lockout and play under the terms of the previous CBA. It's that simple. We could have baseball right now. The players are not striking. The owners are locking them out.
And on that note, let's get right into the voicemails. Our first voicemail is from Quinn.
Hey, it's Quinn. So I know I don't speak for all NL fans, but and I know NL fans are generally pretty split on this. But I am in support of the DH. I have a story about this. So, yeah, at the beginning of 2021, towards the beginning of the season, I went to the first baseball game or any sporting, because, yeah, obviously I didn't go to any sporting events in 2020. So it was the first time I had gone to anything in about a year and a half. And it was, yeah, I went to the Cardinals game, and Jack Flaherty hit a home run, and that was very cool. But then what wasn't very cool is about a month after that, he was, while swinging a bat, tore his oblique and was out pretty much the rest of the season. So I will trade off those one cool moments for actually players not getting hurt any day of the week. And then also, going back to what I was talking about like people siding with the owners, I wonder how different it would be. Actually, I don't wonder. I have a pretty good feeling I can guess how different it would be. But how different would it be if, like, with the players, we know everything about them. Like, as soon as the contract is signed, we know how many years it's for, how much money, how the money is split up, like, if there's any incentives, vesting options, anything like that. That's all immediately available for us to know. And then we also know everything about the players. Like, they put their height and weight up on the Jumbotron, and, like, whenever they're hurt, we immediately find out from the press, like, what happened to them. I'm surprised they don't put their Social Security numbers on the back of their baseball cards at this point. But then with the owners, we don't know anything. We kind of know how much they spend on the team, but we... like how much they bought the team for, but then we don't know how much they make year in and year out, except I think the Braves is kind of a little bit, we know a little bit because they're technically owned by Cobb County, I think. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but for the most part, we don't know anything about the owners, and we know everything about the players. Now, if we didn't know anything about the players, how many people would be siding with the owners? I am going to guess that number would be a lot lower.
One eternity later.
Hey, it's Quinn. I hope you guys are feeling better. I think I figured out the theme of the calls from January. So it was Griffey, Ortiz, Jeter, Pudge, and and Chipper, the one where he dropped the ball in the stands. That was hilarious. So that's all people who were inducted into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot in January, I think.
Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner. And Quinn, thank you so much for calling in with your correct answer, because John, DJ Bingington, and I all but forgot about that contest. When we listened to the call, we were like, oh my God, yes, finally, someone listened to us.
Well, as the podcast's resident NL fan, I guess I'll chime in. I'm in the same place that you are, Quinn. I definitely liked not having the DH, you know, but that conversation's over. And yeah, the whole thing with it's not worth pitchers getting hurt. And DeGrom was what changed my mind on that. Second that DeGrom got hurt from swinging a bat, I'm like, all right, I'm good. They don't have to do it anymore. I'd rather see him pitch.
And that always brings up a really funny conversation, because then people are like, oh, well, you know, they're getting hurt swinging a bat. This is so soft, blah, blah, blah. Like, nothing shows how clueless fans are to how fucking hard these guys are doing every movement they're doing on the field. like than people being like, oh, what, he gets hurt with a bat? Oh, what a pussy.
Well, also not for nothing, like specializations. It's literally not the same game anymore. Like, sorry, it's just not. Oh, I should also add just one last thing. I think that if the owners do eventually have to reveal their revenues, they absolutely should have to have their height and weight on there too, so we can make fun of them for that.
Quinn, thank you so much for your call. Our next call is from Bubak.
Yo, kids, it's your favorite, I don't know what I am, Bubak. Listen, last week's, well, I guess it won't be last week's, it'll be this week. But I told you last week, which is now this week, that I wrote like a parody song for the lockout, and I wasn't quite finished with it, but now it's like, now I'm like, I'm kind of over the song, and I apologize, it's been like 2 weeks since I've actually worked on it. And I can't say that it's like I worked on it like I'm in whatever studio and I'm, you know, laying down actual beats and riffs and shit, because I can't play musical instruments. I'm sure if somebody taught me, or if I actually sat down and tried to figure it out, I'm sure I could figure it out. What my talent is that I can write fucking lyrics. So I don't have the greatest singing voice, but I'm there. So here we go.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a lockout, no escape from twitanity. Open your mouth, complain to the owners, please. We're just some spoiled kids, we need our baseball, because it's season comes, season goes, we're real high, we don't know. Anytime the season starts, really, really matters to us, to us. Manfred wants to fuck this game. He's a really big asshole. We all hate him, he's gotta go. Manfred, you're a biggity bitch. You won't do what's best for our game. MLB owners, ooh. Your pockets are lined with gold. Though you act like we think you're a poor. Go to hell, go to hell. And end this lockout now. And that's all I have. And then that, and that's just, you know. So, DJ, I hope you can kind of, I got kind of lost there before I started, and so I hope you can kind of splice and, you know, do whatever you got to do with your magic. But I hope you like the song, guys.
Bubak, buddy, that was fucking awesome. Personally, my favorite part is the MLB owner's pockets lined with gold. I really like that line. It killed me every time I heard it.
Great job, Bubak. That's all I could say. I mean, honestly, I'm feeling pressure now because I haven't pulled a parody out of my ass for this show for a while. So now I feel like I have to.
Well, I mean, low key, I was just thinking like maybe we should do it. I mean, we got nothing but fucking time. What the hell else are we going to do? We might as well do some sort of lockout parody.
A song a month until baseball starts.
Bubak, thank you so much for your call and for your song. Our next call is from Block.
Good afternoon. It's Block. I hope all is well. Let's face it, there's no baseball to talk about. There's no baseball ongoing shit to talk about. So let's broaden our horizons. I really want some of y'all to check out this Time Wave Zero album by death metal stalwarts Blood Incantation before you hang up. It's not a metal album. It's a like a 1970s ambient synth album. It's just all ambient sounds. I just think some of you might find this really, really cool. Others are going to find it really, really boring. But let's face it, there's no baseball to talk about. I mean, the last real baseball news the lot of us had was the Red Sox eliminating the Yankees, but that seems like ancient history. So let's move on. Much love to all of you.
You know what, Block? I am actually going to check this one out because I do like synth art, and I will probably like this, to be honest. Sounds like something that's right up my alley.
Oh, see, I actually like death metal, so I'm definitely checking this out. Can I just say, first off, I love the expression death metal stalwarts. That's great. that in and of itself could be a band name. But yeah, okay, so Time Wave Zero by Blood Incantation. Also, side note, don't death metal bands have the best goddamn band names?
Yeah, they do.
Blood Incantation. Block, I am always here for a good music suggestion. And even though it's not death metal, I love that too. That's before you hang up. That was great. I love synth too. I'm definitely going to check this out, and I will report back next week. Keep those recommendations coming. As long as we don't have baseball, give me some music to listen to.
Block, thanks for your recommendation, and thank you for your call. Our next call is from James.
Hey, guys. I'm actually really glad you guys are doing Star Wars episodes with the Clone Wars. I'm hyped about that. So I guess my question is, when this lockout ends, and it's probably going to be probably maybe like 120 or 130 games, which team or teams benefit the most from having this shortened season, aside from the Dodgers, because we're all going to have those Dodger jokes of, hey, the Dodgers won the World Series in the 60-game season.
To be honest, James, I think it's relative because all the teams are going to be starting at the same time. They're all going to be playing the same amount of games that I think things will shake out as they normally would, especially if they're playing 100-plus games, which I'm still not sure that they will, but that's a large enough sample size that I don't think anyone's really going to benefit from that wouldn't already benefit from just the schedule as it is. Not that they necessarily benefit, they're just built to be able to win more than the other teams.
And James, I have to thank you for bringing up Star Wars in your voicemail, because we did actually start watching Clone Wars, as we talked about, but not enough to like dedicate a whole segment of the show to it, so this is perfect. This is actually worth noting. We're not watching the show in the order it came out. Apparently, there's like this official chronological viewing order that Emily found. And when I say found, again, it's official. It's from Star Wars or Disney or whoever. And it had us start with, to make it chronological, Season 2, Episode 16, Cat and Mouse. And then Season 1, Episode 16, The Hidden Enemy. Do you want to start off, or what did you think, Em?
I mean, I was into it. I thought it was great. I'm really into seeing all of the stories that go down during the Clone Wars, because I mean the saga, the movies, they kind of gloss over it. You have a movie called Clone War or Attack of the Clones, and it's when it starts, but then it's like, then it's only one more movie, and then we're to the 1970 side of the story for some reason. So I'm into like finding out, and I really like to see Anakin as a Jedi for a long time. You know what I mean? Because The movies, it just happens too quickly where it's like, they find him, he joins the Jedi, and then he's fucking turning on the Jedi big time and becoming this evil Sith Lord. So I'm into seeing like him as a good guy for a long time, and then I would imagine towards the end, you start to see a little bit of a turn.
Right. Now, a few things I want to say about this, briefly though. First off, you could totally see, because this is Dave Filoni, obviously, you can see where the Mandalorian came from. Because his approach is very much like, okay, here's something established in Star Wars. What if we take a deeper dive into that, right? Like you just see Boba Fett. It's like, well, what's going on with him? Well, who are the Mandalorians? Blah, 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 blah. Same thing with that. Just like you said, Em, like, you know, the Clone Wars was, in the context of the prequels, almost kind of a throwaway thing that like happened in between two movies, but we don't really get to see it. And we know that, you know, they were generals in the Clone War, yada, yada. So Filoni asks a very simple question. Well, what was that shit like? And not just that, but what about the interplay between, okay, you have this clone army, and we're just taking that exists. Those are real people, though, right? They're all individuals, despite being clones. What's the dynamics like there? Like, all that stuff. Just interesting questions begging to be asked. And I think this show, the whole point is trying to answer those. I really dug how, I liked the format in multiple ways. I liked, first off, the computer animation, which I mentioned to you, Em. I thought I wouldn't like. I really do.
Yeah,
it works so well for Star Wars.
They should have done the prequels in that animation, by the way.
100%.
Or redo it, to be honest.
That would actually be great. Even just from those first two, you know, Cat and Mouse with the whole kind of seeing Anakin commanding the stealth ship and, you know, some tactical stuff. and then
classic
hit an enemy.
Anakin, right? Where he Classic Anakin. Yeah, I'll deliver this. Right, he's like, actually, let me do this thing that you told me not to do, Master.
Anakin being headstrong and defiant, what? And then in Hidden Enemy was, I thought, maybe even cooler because you got to see some interplay between the clones. It was almost like a bottle episode, you know what I mean? Where, yeah. I mean, granted, it wasn't a pure bottle episode. They did some other stuff. But just in terms of like, hey, again, you know, they have personalities and they're different people and, you know, someone betrays them. But even thinking of like, oh, they think of themselves as brothers. Of course they would. Like, it's just stuff we wouldn't think of. Some of it almost seems like spelling out the obvious, but I guess it's more so like making it canon. Like, oh yeah, of course that would be that. Like, it just makes sense that all these things exist. You know, does that make sense? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree and am with that. And it's something that I never thought of watching the prequels, and now I do. And what I'm really excited, another thing that I'm excited to see how it plays out is now that they're going to establish like how individual the clones are. They're not just like these mindless clones. Like, so how are they going to, how did Order 66 then go down? Because we are clearly seeing like there's a brotherhood and they have loyalty to each other and some are turning or whatever, but literally on a dime, Order 66 happened and then guys who were like backing up Obi-Wan Kenobi, etc., suddenly just stopped and then started firing on him in Revenge of the Sith. So like, how is that going to play out over the course of the series? Because that's going to come to light too.
It is. And I mean, I think that they may be setting the groundwork for that with, you know, some of the stuff that Slick said at the end of that second episode where he's saying like, you know, we're essentially your slaves and, you know, I'm just trying to be free and stuff like that. And that's interesting too, because that's another real world component. It's like, oh yeah, why are we assuming that they're all into this? If they all have their own personalities and opinions, you know, they're not robots. It's like, yeah, some of them might not be into what they were born into without a choice. You know, it's big stuff. So I'm really excited at the potential to just, even just those two episodes, they were so drastically different, the types of stories that they went out of their way to tell. So there's just unlimited potential I could see. And last thing I want to say, this blew my mind. The voice of all the clones is Dee Bradley Baker, who is the voice of Klaus on American Dad, which is a favorite of us on the podcast.
Hey, a shout out for Klaus.
Oh, shout out for Klaus.
Yes, yeah, that was just too funny.
James, thank you so much for your call. Our next call is from Tom.
Hey, guys, it's Tom McCarthy at Tom and Quincy on Twitter. Hey, I called last week, and we were hoping that, you know, they'd be able to get in a room and figure some stuff out so the season wouldn't be interrupted. Obviously, they couldn't, you know, get together and get on the same page about that. So now we have to deal with the fact that what we didn't want with the cancellation of opening day is going to be pushed out to at least 2 weeks. I say it's going to go at least to the mid-May, and now you're going to really piss me off to no end. I'm tired of this, and fans like us do not deserve what the owners have done. I'm sick of it.
Tom, I think it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. We totally agree with you. I mean, the owners have royally fucked this up, and for what? For like a fraction of what their wealth is, most of them. I mean, like, I think 2/3 of them are billionaires. The other ones are damn near close to being a billionaire. So the fact that they're willing to just totally cancel and destroy something that means a lot to our country and to so many of the citizens in such difficult times is just really unfathomable to me. And they can fuck all the way off.
Can I just say briefly, and I don't mean this as an insult, Tom didn't really say anything in the voicemail that we didn't already know, but it was so nice to hear it in that thick Boston accent because it's just got that like aggressive, pissed off quality, even if you're not saying anything mean. So like it just, I don't know, it had some forcefulness to it. You know what it reminded me of? One of my favorite all-time Simpsons scenes where Lisa is gets lost on the bus and she winds up in Little Moscow and there's the two Russian guys playing chess and she asks them for directions and the one guy just starts screaming at her in Russian and the subtitles are like, oh, little girl, yeah, you know, you just need to go down there, you hang a left and somebody
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Our last call is from Nick.
Hey, guys. So we're getting to a point to where it's clear that the owners are staying pat. The PA is staying strong. But if you are the Players Association and you know the owners aren't going to give in much more than they already are now, and you're not going to get what you're trying to get back, even though it's in the owner's best interest to lose this one, if you were the Players Association, would you just try to get the very best and just say, hey, we're going to make an agreement here? Or would you just stand strong and just delay the season as much as possible? And I'm looking forward to the rest of your Harry Potter list, Emily. And John, I hope you're on this week, and I hope you're feeling better. Take care.
Nick, I would be on board with whatever the Players Association wanted if I were a member of the Players Association. So I would not be trying to get them to sign a shitty deal or whatever. It's all about the future, because these CBAs last for 5 years. So it's not just as simple as, oh, let's just accept this and play ball. They've been doing that the last few, and now it's gotten to the point where they have to do this. So I'd be all in.
Yeah, Nick, thank you for the kind words, first and foremost. I appreciate it. I'm just going to nitpick for a second here. I agree with Emily 100%, but just the way you phrased something, I just want to point out, it's not delaying it as long as possible. It's delaying it as long as is necessary. And that's what I support.
And Nick, thank you for providing, once again, the best segue into, I almost said our top segment. This is going to be my, I'll say definitive, but I know that I will probably disagree with it by the time I hear this episode on Saturday. But this is my definitive top 8 Harry Potter movies, because I've now watched all of them ad nauseum since I last spoke, which is hilarious because anyone who listened to the last episode or anyone who didn't, I ranked the 6.5 that I had seen up to that point, and I was not very sold on it, but now I am fucking, I'm all in. I'm in love with it.
Now, if I could just chime in before Emily starts it in her list, just for clarification. So I was somebody who, I read the Harry Potter books as they came out when I was a kid. I saw the first couple movies as a kid, but having already read the, I stuck with the books, I just didn't continue with the movies. So at this point, Emily, you may have seen some of these movies more than I've seen them, even though I read all the books first. Because besides 1 and 2, 3 through 8, I saw only for the first time last summer, I think. It had taken long enough. They were all on HBO Max. I was like, all right, fuck it. I know the story, but let me watch them. So I'm just here to criticize and, you know, compliment you where you're right and inform you where you're mistaken.
Well, I'd like to point out that this is movies only, because I've only just started reading the books, and I'm being told, and I already knew this, because the books are always better than the movies. Literally, oh, yeah. There's no exception to that rule. So this is the best possible scenario for me, because I got to love the movies because I didn't know the source material yet. And now I'm going to read it and I'm going to fucking go crazy over the books, I'm sure, without then having the movies come out and be like, this movie sucks. So I got the best of both worlds. With that being said, I'm starting at 8.
Wrong. Oh, sorry, I got ahead of myself there. Go ahead.
Well, I had been grouping the Deathly Hallows together as one movie because it's really one story. But then people were asking me for my top 8. So I was like, I guess I'll split them up as separate
movies. I believe
Potter
fans do differentiate between the two, yes.
All right, fair enough. Because I am now a Potter fan, so I will follow suit. My 8 is The Sorcerer's Stone. And I definitely like it a lot more than I did in my first ranking of it, now that I've seen it a few times. And can I just also say, this is a really tough list, because I really love all of these movies. Like, being 8 implies that I don't like it when I actually do. So it's just 8 because there are 7 other movies that were way better than it.
Interesting. See, I usually put that higher because it introduces the whole world to the audience. And I think it does a really good job of doing that. It's also the movie with just like the lightest, kind of like most fun tone overall. Shit gets dark.
My 7 was Deathly Hallows Part 1. My 6, Order of the Phoenix.
I'm with you on those, yep.
5, Goblet of Fire. That's where shit gets very dark. That's like where the switch happens.
Which is why I normally, that's like probably top 3 for me because of the switch, but okay.
And it may be top 3 for me next week because I do love that movie, but like sometimes Cedric Diggory's death is like too sad for me. Like depending on the day, I'm like, I can't bear with this loss.
No, wait, hang on. Remind me. Umbridge was that Phoenix or?
Yeah.
That was, yeah. Okay. That needs to be low because of her. And it's because she did such a good job as an unlikable character. That woman kills it, but She's so unlikable that, yeah, the movie drops in rating for me.
And also, fucking that scene in the beginning where, you know, Harry and his cousin Dudley, they get attacked by the Dementor that is in their world. Like, Dudley is such a fucking tool bag throughout the whole series, but that in particular, because now he's like a teenager and he's like bullying Harry with his friends. Like, how Harry didn't just fucking, I don't know. The self-control is unreal.
This goes without saying, but if you hate movie Dudley, wait till you get deep into book Dudley.
Real quick, the actor who plays Vernon Dursley in the movies is so fucking great. Like, so many lines of his just absolutely crack me up. Like, he plays it perfectly where you fucking kind of hate him, but he's also like such a bumbling fool too, right? That like, it's just, it's great. And I hope that it is true to the book because I kind of like that character low key now. My number four, and John's not going to be too happy about this at number four, but Prisoner of Azkaban.
What? That's the best movie. It's the best book. Guys, have a good week. Took off my headphones. I wish we were recording video. You could see that.
Soon enough, we will be. We've been saying that for a year, but soon enough, we'll do video. One of these days. But The Prisoner of Azkaban, now, I really love this one because I was truly shocked at the end when you find out that, you know, Scabbers has been Peter Pettigrew and all that whole scene. I did not have any clue that that was going to happen. Whereas the end of the whole series where you find out about Snape and everything, like, I kind of already knew that he was a good guy because of just pop culture references, mainly American Dad. They have a whole episode about it.
Oh, yeah, when Steve works for the drug dealer and thinks that he's a wizard, right?
Potions class! Did you get all this stuff from Professor Snape?
You do not freaking ask who we got this from.
He who shall not be named.
You'll probably turn out to be a good guy.
Exactly, right?
My number three is Half-Blood Prince. I've been pretty into that one as of late. The number two, Chamber of Secrets. Now, this might be the biggest jump because I ranked Chamber of Secrets somewhere.
Yeah, you didn't like that one.
No, I didn't, but now I really love it. The whole Tom Riddle diary and that whole thing, like, because it was like the first Horcrux. Obviously, you didn't know that really at the time.
Right.
But I just loved how it all tied together.
And you know what I always wondered, and maybe somebody knows the answer to this, but an author will always tell you that, you know, oh, I had it planned out all the way from the beginning. But I wonder, because like I go back to Lord of the Rings, right? So like, just quick, Tolkien writes The Hobbit. He has Bilbo find this ring that makes him invisible. It was only after the fact when he decided to write Lord of the Rings that he was like, okay, this is actually going to be one of the great rings of power. And then he built up the story from there. I wonder when she wrote book two, if she knew what she was going to do with the Horcruxes and all that, or if when she was, you know, a couple books later, she was thinking like, oh, I could take the diary and make that the first one and expand from there. I'm wondering what the chicken and the egg is in that situation.
And I was also wondering because, and maybe, actually, maybe this kind of can give a answer to your question is, I don't know if she necessarily did, because as we find out at the end, that Harry is a Horcrux.
You're a wizard, Harry.
You're a Horcrux, Harry. Just reveals the whole plot in the first book, and Harry has no idea what he's talking about.
In that scene, in the Chamber of Secrets, right as he kills the basilisk with the Sword of Gryffindor, he gets pierced in the arm by the Basilisk Fang, which, as we know, is one of the things that is able to destroy the Horcruxes. So, like, it didn't destroy Harry, and the Phoenix was able to heal it with, like, two tears. So maybe that is, like, she wasn't on that road yet.
Okay, it's been a minute, but I think they might be a little clearer in the books that, like, Harry would might not have made it long-term without Fox saving him. It was something, I think it was like supposed to be like
sense.
A fatal thing, but you know, Fox saved his life type thing.
Right. And what takes, you know, 15 pages, they can only do in like a minute and a half.
Right.
So.
Oh, he's fine. Let's wrap this up. Go on to book three.
Now, my number one favorite Harry Potter movie as of today recording is The Deathly Hallows Part Two. The way that the story wraps up, and I love like, all Voldemort and his whole fucking army, like, descending on Hogwarts. I love all the teachers and stuff put, like, the shield over. And I love when McGonagall, like, does the spell that all those huge, like, the huge cement, like, soldiers come to life. And she's like, protect our school, do our duty. She's like, I always wanted to say that spell. Like, there's just something about that whole fucking movie that I just really, really like. And I love Neville Longbottom, so I love him fucking coming out in the end and like being like a Loki hero.
Yeah, they go into a little more detail in the books about Neville and especially Neville's parents. That's really cool. Okay, so just very briefly, because I know nobody gives a shit about my ranking, so I'm not going to bore you with that. But I just want to say very briefly my piece on 3. I think 3 is so good because honestly, I find Voldemort at times to be a bit of a cop-out villain. He's too powerful. He's too arch. It's too yada yada. Book 3 is the one where she didn't have Voldemort pretty much at all. So she had to, you know, all the twists and turns and, you know, you think you know the bad guy, but then it's somebody else. Like, I just thought it was so interesting what she did without the obvious, like, all right, when's the Voldemort confrontation coming? Like, don't get me wrong. There's a confrontation it builds to in the Shrieking Shack, obviously. But she didn't have that. And again, I say easy, like obviously he's central to the overall plot of Harry Potter. Voldemort has to be there. But I don't know, man, something about not having him to fall back on as the villain, I thought made for just a fantastic story in the book and the movie. That's why I like 3 so much. And that's why Emily pointed that out when she ranked it way too low. Way too low.
I also love the part of that story where like it turns out that Harry and Hermione, you know, they had the time thing from Dumbledore. So like he was the one who actually had that Stag Patronus. Like you find out that it's like he's the one who did
so
that.
Like cool.
That shit was so awesome. And I was so devastated when I thought that they cut off Buckbeak's head. I was like, no. When I first watched it, I said to DJ Bingston, I was like, please do not tell me they cut off this thing's head. When they did, I was like, oh my God. So at the end, I was so fucking relieved.
I think that when you get to book 3 and read it, you'll get what I'm talking about.
That about wraps it up for Breaking Balls this week. We want to thank all of our listeners. You guys are awesome for sticking with us through this arduous lockout. We also want to thank our
callers. I thought
you
were going to say this arduous episode.
Maybe that too. I mean, who's to say, right? You guys need to judge
that. I'm
sorry.
I'm supposed to be gone by this point. Bye, everybody.
We also want to thank our callers. You guys are awesome. Anyone else listening wants to get in on the fun, criticize my Harry Potter rankings, give the Breaking Balls hotline a call. 631-820-7377. You can also find us on Twitter at BreakBallsPod. And we want to thank our amazing producer and engineer, DJ Bingington. You can find him on Twitter as well, at DJ B-I-N-G-I-N-G-T-O-N. And we will catch you guys next week.